cannot have a commander-in-chief that is not ready the first day in office, because Vladimir Putin is not going to wait for the next president to catch up.
This crazy fighting we do all the time is driving us nuts, but first we got to stand our ground. The president is right to make this appointment to the Supreme Court.
Tim Cook says unlocking one iPhone to help the FBI's investigation could expose many millions of Apple customers to data theft and intrusive surveillance.
The only way we know would be to write a piece of software that we view as sort of the software equivalent of cancer.
Now, WGN Radio's Daily Conversation about the life of business and the business of life. This is The Opening Bell with Steve Grzanich on 720 WGN.
It is 5:10. Good morning, everyone. It is Thursday, February 25th, 2016, a very busy day. Let's get right to it. The intel from global markets. First of all, Asian shares mixed this morning after reversal on Wall Street yesterday, thanks in part to the pickup in the price of crude oil. U.S. crude oil slipped about 2 cents, $32.13 a barrel in electronic trading on the Mercantile Exchange in New York, closed up 28 cents. The Dow yesterday managed to eke out a gain, 53 points. The Nasdaq S&P were also a little higher yesterday, but not by much. Two major government reports out today. The Labor Department reports on the number of people who applied for unemployment benefits last week, and the Commerce Department releases its January report on durable goods. Later in the program, we're going to be talking about the release this week of the existing home sales report. We're going to break it down with one of the experts from the National Association of Realtors to tell us what it means about the bigger economy and for you as a homeowner or a home buyer or home shopper or home seller. Also, you heard there in the opening montage of news happening around the world, Apple, the controversy over Apple. The two big names in that fight were front and center in the media yesterday. Apple CEO Tim Cook defending his company's decision to resist an FBI demand for help in cracking an encrypted iPhone used by the San Bernardino shooter. Cook tells ABC News that it was both hard and right thing to do.
We believe it does put hundreds of millions of customers at risk. In addition, if a court can ask us to write this piece of software, think about what else they could ask us to write. Maybe it's an operating system for surveillance. Maybe it's the ability for the law enforcement to turn on the camera. I mean, I don't know where this stops, but I do know that this is not what should be happening in this country. This is not what should be happening in America. If there should be a law that compels us to do it, it should be passed out in the open, and the people of America should get a voice in that. The right place for that debate to occur is in Congress.
Earlier in the day, Attorney General Loretta Lynch talked about the controversy when she testified before Congress, not mentioning Apple by name.
It's a longstanding principle in our justice system that if an independent judge finds reason to believe that a certain item contains evidence of a crime, then that judge can authorize the government to conduct a limited search for that evidence. And if the government needs the assistance of third parties to ensure that the search is actually conducted, judges all over the country and on the Supreme Court have said that those parties must assist if it is reasonably within their power to do so. And that is what we have been asking, and we owe it to the victims and to the public whose safety we must protect to ensure that we have done everything under the law to fully investigate terrorist attacks on American soil.
The feds say they're only asking for narrow assistance in bypassing some security features of the iPhone. Apple has until tomorrow to file its legal response in federal court. There are a couple of brand new developments in this story today. One of them is that we're learning that Apple has, for a total of 13 times, been ordered by federal courts to do this very thing and has been fighting it behind the scenes and out of the public eye. 13 separate cases. Also, Apple is apparently developing even harder encryption technology for the new iPhone 7 that'll be coming out. There are reports this morning that it will be even harder to crack, and that will make this whole controversy even more inflamed. Well, you remember Radio Shack, the neighborhood store where those of us in broadcasting or the AV geeks in the neighborhood and even Hollywood superstars would go and buy gadgets back in the day? Well, it's trying to make a return, and it's enlisted its new chief creative officer, Nick Cannon, to help.
Radio Shack is back. We ain't never left.
Events in Dallas and New York this week help kick off the new push. Radio Shack's going to feature Cannon's incredible One Bluetooth headphones ABC News correspondent Jim Ryan covered the event in Dallas.
Radio Shack is really just a shadow of what it was 10, 20, 30 years ago when we were kids in a place where you went to get batteries or cables and wires. Nick Cannon, when he was 8 years old, he went to Radio Shack and bought a microphone, that he bought a mixer and some speakers, and said that the people there were happy and helpful and very cooperative. And he remembered that. He says that Radio Shack has always been cool in the back of his mind ever since. Well, now, Nick Cannon, as you know, Steve, has been named the chief creative officer at Radio Shack. And despite its troubled times in the last few years, including a bankruptcy filing, the closure of most of its stores, and the sell-off of a lot of its assets, Nick Cannon says that Radio Shack remains cool in his mind. So he was asked what he's going to do to bring the store chain back, and he says that he'll try to introduce new products. And to that point, he's helping to roll out some new headphones, other audio equipment that he hopes kind of catches some traction for Radio Shack.
ABC News correspondent Jim Ryan in Dallas. At its heyday, Radio Shack had 5,200 stores across the country. It only has about 1,700 now. Nick Cannon later in the morning on CNBC.
When I was like 8 years old, this place I got my first microphone, my first mixer, my first keyboard, all of those things was Radio Shack. And the people in Radio Shack actually taught me how to, you know, hook things up from RCA jacks to conductors and all that stuff.
Those new headphones, by the way, cost about $129. Again, Radio Shack hoping for a comeback. It's 5:15 on the opening bell. Stay with us. We're going to go break down the existing home sales report coming up.
You're listening to the opening bell on 720 WGN.
Good morning. Welcome back to the program. It is 5:21. One digital trends writer put it best. Humanity has been boiled down to six emotions thanks to Facebook, which has rolled out its reactions button to users worldwide. The new emoji come in response to users who complained that they felt restricted by sharing emotions on the social media site, because up until now, there was only that like button. Here's Facebook CEO Mark Zuckerberg.
You know, not every moment is a good moment, right? And if you are sharing something that is sad, you know, whether it's something in current events like the refugee crisis that touches you, or if a family member passed away, then it may not feel comfortable to like that post. But your friends and people want to be able to express that they understand and that they relate to you. So I do think that it is important to give people more options than just like.
Todd Spangler's been writing about this, too. He's the digital editor in New York for Variety on Twitter at X Spangler, and Variety at Twitter at Variety. And he's on with us on the opening bell this morning. Good morning, Todd.
Good morning.
I'm giving you sort of a sleepy, half-sleepy, half-happy face emoticon emoji that you can't see right now. How is this going over?
Well, I think generally people have responded well to it. They like it. Facebook users, as you indicated in your intro, they've been asking for this kind of thing for a long time. And Facebook wants to not only cater to its users to keep them happy, and more than that, they want people to spend more time on the service, as much time as people will give Facebook. So this is another tool to draw people in, make them connect, make them interact in what Facebook hopes is a more meaningful way in some cases.
So the emoticons or the emoji are love, ha-ha, wow, sad, angry. It makes sense, because if you're on Facebook a lot and somebody says, oh, well, my dog died, you can't really like that. Why did it take Zuckerberg and Facebook so long to do this?
Well, first of all, you've got a company that is just massive, and they can't make a decision without affecting literally a billion people like this. So they wanted to be very careful. There were users who did not want any additional change. I mean, it does sort of complicate the way that you interact with your friends on the service. But, they were trying to be mindful of how people would use this and what the reaction would be. And I think on balance, they've done a pretty good job here.
So
the one thing they didn't do was introduce a dislike, which was one of the things that a lot of people had been asking Facebook to do.
Do you think that's in testing or in some laboratory at Facebook somewhere right now, and it may come sooner than later? Because when you hear Mark Zuckerberg, as we played his little cut there at the beginning, he sounds like he gets it, but, you know, it's just not happened.
The you're asking about the dislike option?
Yes, yes.
I think the feeling was, he did address this earlier when they were first talking about testing it. What he told people was that they didn't just want a way to so-called downvote a post, to register if you don't like it. First of all, yeah, I mean, I think what Facebook is saying is that if you don't like something, what does that mean? It's not an emotion per se. So they didn't want something that would really engender sort of this negative interaction, right, which would lead to people potentially sharing less stuff. If, you know, 400 people dislike something you posted, you may be less inclined to do that again. So I think if people mark something as bad or if something makes them angry, those are seen as fostering communication and interaction rather than cutting it off potentially.
This has been rolled out to everybody, and I think the way it works is just when you do a post, you can see the little happy face and pull that down. You can see all your different choices there. But, you know, I guess in the minute or two that we have left here, I wanted to ask you, because it seems like virtual reality is the way that Facebook is heading. It seems to me that sooner than later, we're going to have these goggles on and be able to, if we don't like somebody, maybe flip them the bird or do something even worse with virtual reality, right?
They are definitely testing out virtual reality. They have they bought that Discovery Oculus, which has been one of the pioneers in virtual reality. Look, I don't know that even Facebook knows where VR is headed with respect to social. Their hypothesis is that this would be an even more immersive way of communicating with your friends, right? Never mind the little emojis that you can show your friends. I mean, this would be like you would be able to teleport into your grandmother's living room.
Yeah.
I think that's where they conceptually see this kind of thing going. I don't know that everybody's going to be walking around with goggles on their heads. That seems to be a form factor issue that the industry still has to address.
Todd Spangler is the New York digital editor for Variety magazine, on Twitter at @xpangler and Variety at Twitter at Variety. Todd, thanks for being with us in the opening bell this morning.
Thank you.
Well, I have one other note on social media this morning. Yesterday, Instagram announced that it had now more than 200,000 monthly active advertisers, paying it to reach about 400 million plus active users. That 200,000 numbers up from just hundreds of advertisers only in June. It's 5:28. Let's head off to the newsroom. Vic Vaughn standing by with a very busy morning and a state of emergency in Indiana.
Yeah, a little bit of snow there overnight. And a lot of people still stuck in their cars. So we're going to go over what we found out so far, give you an update on where those states of emergencies are and what roads they don't apply to coming up.
All right, thanks, Vic. It's 5:28.
WGN Radio's daily conversation about the life of business and the business of life. This is the opening bell with Steve Grzanich on 720 WGN.
Good morning. Welcome back to the program. 5:38 now. Despite the economic slowdown and the worst start to the year in recent memory on world markets, the housing sector continues to recover. And some experts and analysts say it will likely help the U.S. economy avoid a recession. January's existing home sales report issued earlier this week is the second highest since 2007, sales up 11% from a year ago. Home sales, resales were up 11% from the largest year-on-year gain since July of 2013. And a separate report, by the way, showed that the Standard & Poor's Case-Shiller Composite Index, 20 metropolitan areas, shows existing home sales 5.7% in December in many metropolitan areas. Lawrence Yoon is a chief economist and senior vice president of research at the National Association of Realtors. He joins us this morning on The Opening Bell. Dr. Yoon, good morning. How are you?
Good morning, and thanks for having me on the show.
I am interested that you are one of the positive, the optimists here who think that these home sale figures are an indicator that the U.S. economy is pretty stable and we will avoid a recession. Tell us about it.
Well, the U.S. economy last year grew a little above 2%. This year, the growth could be actually slower, about 1.5%. But the reason why it's on the positive side is that the housing market continued to recover. As you alluded to, the home sales in January was quite surprisingly high, 11% up from January of last year. Furthermore, prices continued to move up, which means that many homeowners are experiencing positive wealth effect from increasing their home values. So even though the stock market is very wobbly, the consumers should go out and spend more because their the middle class wealth, at least, which is tied to home wealth, is rising.
We want to mention, by again, remind people, these are existing homes, not new homes. The new home sales figures were surprisingly a little lower. What's the difference between the two areas, and why would one be predictive of something positive and the other not?
So the new home sales comprise about 10% of the overall home sales market. So the existing is the dominant. But the new home sale tends to be very volatile month to month. And what we have across the country is currently an inventory shortage, meaning that only way to alleviate inventory shortage is for the home builders to build more. Lately, in the past few months, the builders, for one reason or another, have really not ramped up production, but it's just inevitable they have to produce more. There's a signal from rising prices to say to the home builders, come out and build more. We have a housing shortage. So despite the weakness in January new home sales figure, I anticipate that new home sales for the year as a whole would be about 15% higher.
The existing home sales report showed that regionally, most of the regions did pretty well. The Midwest had one of the largest gains, 8.7%. The Northeast had one of the smallest. Is it surprising to you that all of the regions of the country are doing well?
This is indicating that it is a very broad-based recovery. We have to remember that housing market did go through that harsh pain. We had a bubble crash. Now is a recovery phase. So it's not a new high. It's just an expanding, trying to recover. But it's been a steady recovery and much more sustainable. We are not seeing a frenzy buying activity or loose mortgage credit. So it's much more healthier recovery. But we still have some room to go before we catch up with the prior peak back in 2005. But nonetheless, the current recovery is leading to the positive economic, local economic impact, and hence it should keep the economy on the positive side.
You write in Forbes magazine at Forbes.com that there is one possible negative to all of this, and that is that homeowners who have been renting out property may decide to sell, and the rental market's already pretty tight, right?
The rental market, the vacancy rate for apartment is at near generational lows, and also for single-family rentals are also low, and the rent increases are actually quite good. So as a landlord, it's been decent years. Now that prices are rising, some of the landlords may say, well, let's look at this. Maybe I want to sell my rental property and then put the money someplace else. Maybe they view the stock market as a lower, better value. But we are not really seeing a big momentum of selling rentals. But if there was to sell rentals, that means that more inventory could be coming onto the market. But from the renter side, that means even tighter vacancy rate. And hence, for the renters, it could be even a bigger squeeze with rents rising even faster.
You touched on it briefly there, but mortgage banks are not very easily handing out mortgages these days. Is it a buyer's or seller's market, and where do you see that going?
Broadly speaking, I would say the sellers have slight advantage over the buyers. Because we're still in the winter months, we don't see the acuteness of it. But come spring buying season, I think many neighborhoods will begin to show that there is far fewer inventory to work with than they anticipated. And therefore, the sellers will be in a position to raise the price a little more than last year. So the sellers do have an advantage. From buyers' point of view, some buyers who are able to obtain mortgages, the problem is there's just not enough homes to select from.
Lawrence Yun is chief economist and senior vice president of research at the National Association of Realtors. He oversees the research at the NAR and existing home sales statistics. Dr. Yun, thanks for being with us on the Opening Bell this morning.
Thank you.
You're listening to the Opening Bell on 720 WGN.
It's 549. Welcome back to the program. Dow futures are higher this morning, just a little though, up 33. The S&P futures up about 4. Crude oil is flat this morning, trading at 32.14. More now on commodity prices. Here's Orion Samuelson.
Steve, good morning. In the grain market yesterday, another day of lower wheat prices, down to 5.5-year lows. Because of large global supplies, corn and soybean futures also down for a second day, pressured by the prospect of bumper crops in South America beginning to come to market. They're harvesting their soybeans already, and hopefully they'll be able to move them to foreign buyers. Turning to the market yesterday at the Chicago Mercantile Exchange, live cattle after trading flat to lower in the early action, both feeder cattle and live cattle rallied and closed higher, marking the seventh consecutive higher close in those markets. And despite the Midwest weather, or maybe because of the Midwest weather, there was strength in the live hog contracts yesterday as well. Have a good day. I'm Orion Samuelson.
Thanks, Orion. You have a good day as well. It's called the Internet Tax Freedom Act, and yesterday President Obama signed a permanent extension of the Internet Tax Freedom Act into law. While federal law has long blocked most states from collecting taxes on Internet service, the prohibition has had to be renewed every few years. Not anymore. Ron Cook is with Plant and Moran, a state and local tax Illinois practice leader there. He has been at the forefront of monitoring this for a long time, and he's on with us on the Opening Bell this morning. Good morning, Ron.
Good morning, Steve. How are you?
I'm well, thank you. It has been a long, hard fight, hasn't it? But it's looks like it's finally done. Do we not have to worry about this anymore?
Yes, that's correct, Steve. We do not have to worry about this anymore. It's certainly nice to have some permanency in knowing that this longstanding exemption from sales tax for both individuals as well as businesses is going to be extended permanently.
The thing was, there were some senators, including, I think, Illinois U.S. Senator Dick Durbin, who kind of held this up for a while. There are some who really wanted to tax Internet stuff, right?
Yeah, that's correct, Steve. They absolutely are looking for, you know, really most states are looking for any additional revenues. And this certainly would have been one area that I'm sure they would have liked to have, you know, been allowed to impose taxes on. However, you know, to your point, yeah, they certainly had some compromising in the Senate to even bring this, which obviously passed in exchange for some additional statewide legislation that will probably be voted on later this year that relates to whether or not online retailers have to collect sales tax in all the states in which they sell goods and services into that are otherwise taxable.
Let me play devil's advocate for a second here and say, what's the issue with taxing things on the Internet? Why is that bad?
Well, you know, certainly it's you allow the states to determine what revenue sources they have. You know, with the Internet Freedom Tax Act, you're really looking at, you know, a fledgling industry that originally came about or generated this particular exemption and allows a lot more people to have access to the Internet than may otherwise not have to if they had the additional cost of paying the taxes. And, you know, to be clear about this, Steve, too, what the Internet Freedom Tax Act does not do is it does not exempt online purchases of goods and services that may otherwise be subject to tax. So, for example, if I went and ordered something online from a online retailer and they did not charge me sales tax, then I would have to self-assess and pay that tax to the state of Illinois. And so certainly the states are trying to obtain additional revenue sources through that means, through what may be voted on later this year as a result of a compromise to get the Internet Freedom Tax Act passed.
Do you think that the ban on these taxes for stuff like DSL and other services, is that going to help increase the number of people who have access to that service? Because there are still many parts of the country that really lack in this area.
Yeah, I think it might help have or provide for additional folks to have access to the Internet, again, because you know they're not having additional costs of paying taxes on Internet access, which is what this with this law does.
And what other fights might be hiding? And is there anything hidden in this bill that is going to pop up later that's going to surprise us all?
You know, I don't believe so, Steve. I think at least with respect to the Internet Freedom Tax Act, I think that it's pretty straightforward in that it's going to be permanent and that I don't think that there's going to be other things that should surprise us going down the road.
Well, it's good that this is done. Again, President Obama signed this yesterday, the permanent extension of the Internet Tax Freedom Act. And Ron Cook, very good of you to be with us in the opening bell this morning.
Great. Thank you very much, Steve. I appreciate your time.
Ron Cook at Plant Moran. He heads up the state and local tax practice for Illinois. That's the opening bell for this morning. We want to thank our producer, Mary Sandberg, our engineers, Ben Cortez, production help this morning from Ross Cochran, Kevin Powell. The Steve Cochran Show's next. We'll be back bright and early tomorrow morning at 5 o'clock with the opening bell. Have a great day. It's 5:55. It is 5:58, and it's time for the Steve Cochran Show. Let's head down to the Allstate Showcase studio. Good morning, guys.
You know, I was in transit. What did your internet taxation guy say?
He said that this is obviously a good thing, that it is hopefully going to help get people access to internet service in areas where they were fearful that this tax would have been, you know, burdensome and preventative. Because, you know, for a lot of people, especially like senior citizens and people over 50, they can't afford broadband. And so, you know, these as we move into this new tech age of healthcare at home, they really need that for mm-hmm. survival. And so anything that makes that cheaper is good.
Yeah, and the large question that still kind of hangs out there is, if you don't tax all internet purchases, then how does brick and mortar exist in the long run? Could you fix that for me?
Well, yeah, I wish I could.
We got like a minute. I mean, that's plenty of time.
It's one of those challenges because I don't know about you, but I don't shop at brick and mortar stores anymore. I rarely go and buy.
Oh, yeah. No, I go out. I like people. I like to go out and see human beings. You got to get out of the house, Steve. I'm going to pick you up, drop you off at the mall. I want you to say hi to some people.
Yeah.
You know, greet others.
Maybe we could go together and just kind of walk around and just do some shopping. And
now there's a picture.
It'll be a bonding moment.
It would be a bonding moment. Might need bond after it. All right. Enjoy the morning and take care of that news end, will you?
All right.